Now Ayatollah Javadi Amuli talks about the personality of Shahid Qasem Soleimani.
کمتر وقتی است که من به یاد جناب آقای قاسم سلیمانی باشم و دعا نکنم. اما خیلی به شما عزیزه. همه ما وامدار شهادت و مجاهدت.
Most of the time in my prayers, I remember General Qasem Soleimani. He was very dear to me. We are all indebted to this martyred brother of ours, Shahid General Qasem Soleimani. Last year, he came to the city of Qom to visit the religious authorities here. He had a meeting with me, too. When our meeting was finished and the other people left the room, he asked me to do something for him. He took a piece of cloth out of his pocket and said, "This is a piece of my shroud. Would you sign it for me and testify that I was a faithful person?" I said, "I am not qualified enough to testify this for you. Who am I to do so?" Now he asked me to testify for himself, who was a righteous person. He served his whole life for the cause of Islam. He safeguarded us. He protected us against the enemies. He saved our faces and families. He protected our religion, our Islamic system. He served Imam Khomeini and our current leader. Finally, I accepted and signed his shroud.
گفتیم خدایا تو شاهدی. گفتیم هو شاهد. خدایا تو شاهدی این عزیز ما.
I wrote on that piece of cloth, "Huwa Shahid," which means, "O Allah, I testify that this dear man has served you his whole life." And now you can see that by being martyred on the path of Allah and Islam, he is now in the presence of Allah, and he will be resurrected with the prophets of Allah, the Ahlul Bayt, and the martyrs of Karbala, especially Imam al-Hussein.
Welcome back to the studio. So this is going to continue until the reappearance of the Imam. So, Sheikh Ali.
So, yeah, very good point by Sayyid Mahdi here. You know, his bravery, it was unparalleled. He was not one of those people who would just hide in their bunkers and would like to just, you know, pass on orders and commands, you know, while they're themselves safe and there are some other people risking their lives.
Right.
No. Instead, actually, there are reports, even before his martyrdom, these reports came out that he was always taking the bigger risk and telling his comrades to stay in back, right? He was like, you know, you guys stay here, let me go check it out first. So he was always, he had this type of a personality who would just put himself at risk before he would prescribe it to anyone else, right? Now, in the message that the leader of the Muslim Ummah gave on his martyrdom on January 3rd, 2020, the leader says, "All friends and indeed all enemies should know that the path of jihad and resistance continues with increased motivation, and certain victory awaits the mujahideen on this path." So this, if you look at this message of the leader, he's very clearly giving us a roadmap of what to do and where this movement is going to proceed and in what manner and what fashion. Sometimes, you know, the enemy, their calculation is that once we take out, for instance, a person like General Qasem Soleimani, everything is going to stop. Well, their miscalculation is very natural because they do not understand Islam, the culture of martyrdom, the readiness of Muslims to sacrifice on the path of divine, achieving divine justice and those just societies and this Islamic civilization and the reappearance of Imam Zaman alayhi salam, which is going to be the climax of this movement.
Yeah,
right?
And they don't understand Iranians. Either.
They don't understand this nation, Iran, right? Iranians are very different people. You know, if you were to compare Iranians to even other nations in the region, I can tell you very comfortably, and I'm not an Iranian, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm telling it, that it's not comparable. Iranians are different. Their mindset is different. The more you suppress them, the more they actually get stronger. And this is what the Inqalab and the revolution has showed us in the last 40 years. But again, the United States of America doesn't get it. Why? Because they have this intrinsic arrogance, right? The Taghut, the Fir'aun, they, in all times, they have this something about their power that does not let them come to the understanding, the real understanding of the ground realities. And this is what America has been facing. For 40 years, they've been putting embargoes, trade embargoes, sanctions, economic sanctions on Iran, all kinds of difficulties. What was the result of all this?
Right.
The result of all this, that Iranians got more united, the Iranians saw through that the enemy is plotting against them, the Iranians strategized, the Iranians became self-dependent, the Iranians actually started to work on their economy of resistance, which means that they're not going to be relying on the external powers and other countries for running their economy and their own local operations. All of that is happening because of the miscalculations of the arrogant powers led by America. This path, this path is unstoppable, right? If you look at the, you know, interestingly, if you look at the Iranian people and Iranian nation, one can argue that if they were left alone, they probably wouldn't have been able to be this successful if they were not, you know, tickled in the feet, right, through these sanctions and through these international pressures and whatnot. This very thing actually got them going. And now the martyrdom of Qasem Soleimani, this shaheed, this great martyr, it has actually taken things to the next level.
Really
even
has,
those
really
who were
has,
arguing
yeah.
that, okay, we can probably have negotiations with the great Satan. they are the enemies, but, you know, today's economy, you know, we have to keep that in consideration. You know, they were going on that route and they were pushing for negotiations. Even them are not saying anything less than debt to America today.
Yeah.
They're like, no negotiations. We're not looking to have peace with America,
Allahu Akbar.
Right? Even those factions. So this martyr, this special martyr, has done something that was not able to be done in last 40 years. The Iranians were not able to achieve that in last 40 years. But this sacrifice, this great sacrifice, has actually made that happen today. And, you know, with this, I would like to congratulate once again to the Islamic movement and the Islamic Ummah, and especially the Iranian nation, for keeping up this fight and, you know, getting ready to completely defeat the enemy of humanity, that is the United States of America.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Ali. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mahdi. Dear Iranian nation, you are an inspiration to us all. Inshallah, we'll see you next time.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please, don't forget to log on to our website at parsetoday.com. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Great hero, General of Hearts. former top commander of the RGC Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the deputy commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Organization, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes, and their eight companions attained martyrdom on 3rd of January 2020 in a terrorist attack near Baghdad Airport under direct orders of the outgoing criminal U.S. President Donald Trump. The despicable move occurred whilst Lieutenant General Soleimani had been invited by the Iraqi government and was in Iraq as a guest of the Iraqi government. Donald Trump resorted to his usual excuses to justify his criminal act, trying to say that the act of terrorism was a preemptive move to prevent war in the region. This came whilst U.S. officials themselves had admitted that martyred General Qasem Soleimani played an unmatched role in weeding out terrorism in the region and even prevented the influx of terrorists into Europe and beyond. CNN's website wrote just 2 days after the martyrdom of General Soleimani that senior security officials in the United States were seriously trying to defend the White House's claim that General Soleimani's assassination had been carried out in reaction to the immediate threats of this general to American interests. However, it added, lack of evidence had cast doubt in Congress and public opinion on whether Donald Trump had done the right move. The assassination of the top Iranian general, a public hero fighting against terrorism, clearly proved that the United States is not fighting terrorism, but it is in fact the partner in crime of terrorists, and indeed the United States is the main supporter of terrorism, a rogue element in the region. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, as a top military strategist, unmasked the mendacity of the U.S. claims of combating terrorism. The United States has been propagating for 2 decades that it is seeking to bring security and stability to West Asia, whereas the terrorist American army has directly or indirectly committed the most heinous crimes in a number of regional countries, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and other places. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, the United States does not want to destroy Daesh terrorists, but it wants to administer and control Daesh in a way to use it as an instrument for advancing its own nefarious goals in the region. But the great martyr of the Islamic resistance, General Qasem Soleimani, and his companions thwarted this U.S. plot. Iran's advisory role in Syria and Iraq paved the way for the resistance front and nullified the sinister schemes of the United States and the Zionist regime, which were trying to disintegrate regional countries through their mercenaries and also through Daesh terrorists which they controlled. U.S. President Donald Trump openly admitted that he issued the order for the assassination of the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, but later evidence also proved Israel's role in this act of terrorism. The Zionist regime's Minister of War, Naftali Bennett, referring to what he called the time of ending of Iran's presence in the region, had offered menacing remarks against Iran. The Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had a telephone contact with U.S. Secretary of State just 3 days before this act of terrorism. Netanyahu had thanked Mike Pompeo for important measures against Iran. Pompeo acknowledged in a speech that the IRGC has been blacklisted because of its threats against the Israeli regime. The Israeli Daily Jerusalem Post wrote that Mike Pompeo had said this in the session of the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee. It doesn't matter because the United States and Israel are the two sides of the same coin. The act of terrorism against Iran's top general and military commander had been put on American and Israeli agenda at a time that Washington's maximum pressure policy against Iran has been seen to be failing. The United States has been frustrated because its embargo and economic sanctions were not working against Iran. The multi-million-strong funeral ceremonies for the heroes of resistance, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were a clear message to the criminal regime in Washington and the regime in Tel Aviv and their accomplices and their allies in Europe. The global arrogance and global Zionism fully realized that hatred against them had spread well beyond Iran and Iraq, into Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, and the wider region, and even parts of Europe. This volcano of disgust against the United States and the Israeli regime cannot be extinguished by tweets and threats. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, referring to the elements of the Iranian nation's power and steadfastness against the enemies, had said, "The enemy has tried its utmost. It has not come short in its wickedness. The aim is to force officials to capitulate and change their calculations and to submit to U.S. demands. It means that they surrender to the United States and people are put against the system. This is the enemy's goal. America's calculations are wrong. They are misguided. They have made such calculations for the past 40 years and have not gained any results. They have lost and they have failed to deliver a blow to the Islamic Republic. It is the same now. This time too, they will definitely be defeated. There is no doubt about it. Yet, despite the grudge that they have against the Islamic Iran, this has blinded them. I mean, it has destroyed their calculations and they cannot make proper calculations." Dear listeners, recent developments in the region bode well for the future of this region, and the United States will soon be forced to leave this region. The countdown has already started. The Iraqi Parliament's ratification on 5th of January 2020, demanding that all U.S. military forces should leave Iraqi territory, is in effect the start of the countdown for America's exit from the West Asia region.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech of Ayatollah Khamenei delivered on January 8, 2020, in a meeting with the people of the city of Qom. The meeting was held on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Shahid Soleimani would embrace danger, and he had no fears. His courage showed itself not only in recent events, but also during the Sacred Defense era, during which time he was the commander of the Tharallah army. Both he and his army showed exemplary courage, and he was a man of wisdom as well. He would think carefully, and he had reasons for his actions. This simultaneous courage and acumen manifested itself not only in the arena of the military, but also in the arena of politics. I said this many times to the friends active in the arena of politics, as we were witness to his behavior and his actions. He was courageous and wise in the arena of politics as well. His words would exert tremendous influence, and they were convincing. Above all, he was pure and sincere. He would expend his courage and acumen on the path of God, and he was not a hypocrite and a pretentious man.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want of me. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Sincerity is very important. We should practice sincerity as well. Another one of his qualities was that despite being a commander who had mastery over the military, he was very careful to observe Shar'i principles. Sometimes, people forget about Shar'i principles in the arena of war, saying that there's no time for that. But he was very careful in this regard. He would not use weapons if he did not deem it necessary. He would take care not to transgress against other people's rights. He would exercise caution in areas that people do not deem necessary, but he would try to be cautious. He would embrace danger, but at the same time, he would protect others' lives as far as he could. He would watch over the lives of his comrades, his soldiers, and his colleagues from among other nations who stood beside him.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
The United Arab Emirates has become a trade hub in the region with strong links across West and South Asia and Europe. The country has, among other things, been trying to establish itself as a large and fast-growing marketplace for gold. According to data collected by the Observatory for Economic Complexity, the UAE's gold imports have increased by an average of 58% to over $27 billion in 2018. The Arab country's fondness for gold comes amid its plummeting oil reserves and the UAE's drive to diversify its economy. Gold has proven to be a lucrative commodity in the past months, particularly as investors favored the precious metal as a safe haven during the uncertainties in other markets as the coronavirus pandemic hit. The importance of gold for Dubai's economy is such that its trade volume surpassed that of diamonds, oil, jewelry, and cell phones in 2019.
The United Arab Emirates has no gold on its own, as is clear. They have oil, but they have no gold yet. Gold is their second largest export. So all of their 17.7 billion of their gold export is being imported first and washed or laundered by re-exporting it mainly through the UK into Switzerland and other gold refining places like India.
But there's another side to this story. The United Kingdom's Home Office and Treasury issued a report on money laundering and terrorist financing, labeling the UAE as vulnerable to illicit activities due to a lax policing of gold movements across the country. But how does the UAE acquire all that gold? And where does the country buy the exorbitant amount of precious metal from? According to investigations conducted by The Sentry, an NGO that tracks dirty money linked to African war criminals, 95% of gold officially exported from Central and East Africa, much of it mined in Sudan, South Sudan, the Central African Republic, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, ends up in the Emirates. Gold has funded armed conflicts in the region for years, but the jump in prices in the past few months has turned the metal into new blood diamonds, as it's been increasingly obtained through brutal mining practices and illicit profits, including the use of underage workers.
First, the international gold laundering is a gigantic human rights abuse, foremost because it uses many countries in Africa, in South America, are using massive child labor. Children not only are put in tremendous risks working in the mines, in narrow, rickety underground tunnels that could collapse anytime, and often do, but they are also poisoned on a daily basis by chemicals used in extracting gold from the rock.
In 2016, the UAE declared gold imports from 25 African countries worth $7.4 billion, which had not declared any exports to the UAE. The Emirates declared $3.9 billion more in gold from most of the 21 other countries it imported from than was declared in exports.
Gold laundering is an international crime because it is mostly run by mafia-type organizations, where killing and other type of violence, plus sexual abuse of women, forced prostitution, are a daily occurrence. It's actually the law of the day, you could almost say, in these illegal gold mining areas. There should be an international law enforceable, issued by the UN, if at all possible, and enforced, it must be enforced, by the International Criminal Court against anything to do with gold laundering.
Gold's small size and high price make it a suitable target for smuggling, and the UAE's minimal control and regulations have turned the country into a magnet for the metal. The situation has become so dire that the London Bullion Markets Association called on Dubai and other gold hubs to conform to the regulatory standards or face a blacklisting of their exports. While the UAE has promised more transparency, only time will tell how and to what extent the country will fulfill its pledge.
The U.S. is facing another crisis thanks to the actions of the U.S. President Donald Trump. This time, it has to deal with a massive COVID-19 relief bill. Donald Trump said that he is unhappy with the massive bill, which provides $892 billion in coronavirus relief, including extending special unemployment benefits. $1.4 trillion is also needed for normal government spending. The U.S. President said that he is not signing it, in part because that one-off $600 stimulus checks for struggling Americans are not large enough
I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple.
An increase to the size of the checks was something Democrats attempted to get, but Republicans refused to accept it, throwing it further into doubt the future of any imminent financial relief for millions of struggling Americans. However, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to hold a vote to approve the $2,000 checks on Monday. Another objection made by Trump was that the bill gives too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid.
$600 for the past several months that Americans haven't received any assistance is almost nothing. It's $1.75 a day. It's quite pathetic, especially when you look at how the rest of the bill gives millions of dollars. It gives $33 million to Juan Guaido. It gives millions of dollars to Israel to regime change measures. And this $600 essentially is going to go to landlords. It's going to go to banks. Americans are going to see that money, and it will be gone in the next moment.
Trump's refusal to sign the bill is not just affecting jobless benefits. A partial government shutdown will begin on Tuesday, unless Congress can agree a stopgap government funding bill before then. The U.S. president's move surprised many, particularly since Trump left nearly all of the negotiations to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who made no push for the $2,000 stimulus checks that the U.S. president is now seeking. All through the months-long wrangling between Democrats and Republicans over the stimulus package, Trump did not say anything. He didn't object to the terms of the deal before Congress voted it through on Monday. But since then, Trump has constantly complained about it. If he continues to refuse to sign the bill, more than 14 million laid-off Americans could lose their unemployment benefits for weeks. Even if Trump finally agrees to sign it, they would likely suffer a break in payments. States cannot pay out benefits for weeks that begin before the bill is signed. Now, as a result of Trump's refusal to sign the bill, benefits will not restart until the first week of January, but they will still end in mid-March, effectively trimming the extension to 10 weeks from 11. Moreover, a series of additional relief provisions, including an eviction moratorium, are set to expire at the end of the month. Other temporary relief protections shielding millions of Americans from the brunt of the pandemic's economic toll will lapse shortly after the new year without action. Top officials, including Pelosi and Mnuchin, are now privately discussing plans such as a stopgap spending bill in case Trump formally vetoes the measures by Monday. But it is not clear how long that stopgap measure would last or whether Trump would sign it if it makes none of the changes that he wanted. Trump never said that he would veto the legislation anyway. However, he may not have to. The legislation passed with the support of, well, more than two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, easily surpassing the threshold required to override a veto if he actually did that.
It appears to be a partisan divide. Now Trump is saying he won't sign the stimulus package because it's too low. But we also have to look at the fact that when this bill was signed, it was signed with a supermajority in both houses, in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And we got to also remember that the Democrats are now have the majority in the House of Representatives. So because they had two-thirds in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, it really doesn't matter if Trump refuses to sign it or not. Of course, the Congress would hope that Trump signs it and that they can get it done, but they could still veto his veto.
But in this scenario, timing means everything. The legislation can become law 10 days after the bill is enrolled, even without a presidential signature. But because the time frame overlaps with the end of the current Congress in January the 3rd and the convening of the 117th Congress, some called a pocket veto can become a possibility. A pocket veto is a legislative maneuver that allows the U.S. president or another official with veto power to exercise that power over a bill by taking no action instead of affirmatively vetoing it. If that happens, all legislation dies with Congress. So without Trump's signature in the next 10 days, the bill would have to be reintroduced and voted on a second time. This means more delay in funding of the government, and providing relief to struggling Americans and businesses.
Yemen is currently the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Yemeni people are facing a long list of unbearable problems such as daily airstrikes, famine-like conditions, different deadly diseases, and an economy in tatters. Meanwhile, Yemeni children are undoubtedly the most vulnerable part of the population. The situation of children in Yemen has been described as a crisis within a broader humanitarian catastrophe. This week, Yemen's health minister once again raised the alarm about the situation of children in his country. Taha al-Mutawakkil said 3,800 children have been killed in attacks carried out by the Saudis and their allies over the past years. He also warned that the aggressor's bombardment campaign has devastated Yemen's health infrastructure, making it increasingly difficult to save children. The plight of the Yemeni kids has once again come under the spotlight just a few months before the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led military offensive against Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from a preventable disease, 2 million are out of school, and thousands have been killed or maimed since 2015. The United Nations has been quite loud in voicing concern about the ongoing crisis, but it is also under fire for removing the Saudi-led coalition this year from a blacklist of child killers. The Saudi-led alliance was first blacklisted several years ago for killing and injuring children in a war.
The United Nations, of course, has this very typical, very endemic weakness, I dare say, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action. And we have seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
It was on March 25th, 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, began pounding Yemen from air, sea, and ground. Now, another anniversary of the beginning of the offensive is drawing close with no end in sight to the campaign. Why is this war dragging on so long, and why is the international community failing to put an end to it? The invaders launched a bloody offensive in the hope of achieving a quick victory. However, to this day, none of the stated goals of the military campaign have been met, with the Saudi-led onslaught being described as a fiasco. But the invaders are not changing course. They have indiscriminately bombarded civilian areas. Markets, funerals, weddings, jails, medical and water supply facilities have all been hit. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Western countries, particularly the United States and Britain, have refused to review their ties with Saudi Arabia over the bloodshed in Yemen. They have instead intensified their backing of Al Saud. The United States and Britain have stepped up their arms sales to the regime despite the human suffering in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States has provided the Saudi and Emirati forces with different types of military assistance. Critics insist the heavy U.S. military support has made America a partner to the devastating war. Observers believe without Western diplomatic and military support, the onslaught would have ended a very long time ago.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran, and Tehran, in return, will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance in action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically, that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. president-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism? The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is the last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent UN inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were, despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadline set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayr din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
La ilaha illallah.
are going to talk about miscellaneous issues related to Islamic laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, a very quick question that might be really, desirable at the beginning of this episode is that, you know, in some countries, especially where there are deserts and people live in the deserts like Bedouins, and they might access different kinds of animals such as rabbits or hares, or even in Australia, for example, in the deserts of Australia, you may find kangaroos. Are they basically ritually edible or halal?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would like to say that some Muslims, not Shia Muslims, but of course Sunni Muslims, eat rabbit meat, and of course according to their school of jurisprudence, rabbit is halal. But according to the school of Ahlul Bayt and the Shia school, of course rabbit is haram and there is no doubt about it. As for kangaroos are concerned, of course kangaroos are also haram, and the Shia scholars are all unanimous about the kangaroos being haram.
Mm-hmm.
So we should understand that especially the Shia Muslims living in a predominantly Sunni community,
yes,
they should understand that there are some differences. Yeah, when it comes to halal and haram things that we consume on a daily basis, there are some things which are halal according to Sunni Islam or according to Hanafi or Shafi'i, Hanbali, Maliki schools, but those things are haram according to us. For example, rabbit is it's commonplace among Sunnis. It's halal, okay? But for us, it is haram, and we cannot consume it. Even if it's the hair of a rabbit, the hair of a rabbit, if it is on your clothes or on your body, and you know that it is, you cannot pray with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is basically haram for the Shias to consume rabbit meat and also kangaroos.
Oh, right. What about use of properties of a non-Muslim person? Can we basically make use of the properties that belong to a non-Muslim? And if he or she is a Muslim but doesn't pay the khums, the one-fifth, like type of charity where you have to actually pay like one-fifth of your capital,
yes,
if it stays somewhere for more than 1 year, you know, can we make use of the property of a person, even of a Muslim? I'm talking about a Muslim, but doesn't really pay homes.
Well, as for, because you asked me two questions. The first one, can we, for example, use the property of a non-Muslim? I think we cannot use non-Muslims' property. Their property is inviolable, in the sense that we cannot use their property without their consent, without their permission, unless authorized by them. We cannot use their property illicitly and unlawfully.
No, that was not the case. Basically, I asked the question like when they authorize it, when they give us something.
That's something else, of course. Of course, if they offer you food to eat, okay, like even if you are living in a country like India with majority Hindu population,
mm-hmm,
or with Sikh population, there are let's say 1 billion Hindus living in India, more than 1 billion,
mm-hmm,
and these are people you live with on a daily basis. You interact with them.
Yes,
if they offer you food and you don't know at all, you don't know that the food is impure or it contains haram ingredients, as long as the food does not contain meat,
mm-hmm,
you can eat it. You can eat, for example, biscuits, cookies, and food mm-hmm products,
yes,
which are produced in the same country, without having to investigate whether the food or the product is pure or impure. You can treat them as pure.
Yes.
This is the answer to the first question. As for the second question is concerned, the thing that is given to you to consume, to eat, and you know that the khums of that item has not been paid, or maybe you have doubt about it. Of course, according to Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, you can eat that food, and it's not your responsibility to give khums of that property or that thing. For example, to make it a bit clear, the breadwinner of a family, the father, for example, goes out working, he saves his money, and he does not pay khums.
Mm-hmm.
He's not in the habit of paying khums. And at the end of the year, he gifts some money to his children. Now, some of the children want to know whether it's their responsibility to check whether the khums khums has been paid from that amount or not, or they don't have to check. Of course, according to Supreme Leader, it's not their responsibility to check whether khums has been paid from that amount, from that gift, or not. It is absolutely halal for the children, for the wife,
mm-hmm,
for the dependents to take that money and to use it for any purpose they
want. Without investigation.
Even if they know for sure that that Khums has not been paid from that money, even then it's permissible for them to use that money, and it's not necessary.
Aren't they obliged actually to pay the Khums? No, after they made certain.
Yeah, even if they made, it's not because they are dependents. They are not the people who earn money, actually save the money. Of course, it's not their responsibility to pay khums from that amount. And it, of course, the father who is actually the guardian of the family and who is the breadwinner, it is his responsibility to purify his property, to give khums from whatever he has saved and over which 1 year has passed, okay?
Yes.
If he does not pay, he will remain indebted, he will remain liable for the khums amount.
Right. But does the same rule apply to zakat, another type of charity which is prevalent in Islam?
Zakat, as you know, zakat is not payable on your savings. Mm-hmm. For example, you have $1 million saved in your bank account. Zakat is not payable on it. Zakat is payable on specific items like wheat, like barley, like dates, like raisins, like sheep, camels, cows. And these are the things.
And some agricultural products.
Of course.
Right?
Wheat,
like wheat, as
wheat
said.
Barley, as I said.
Yes.
So, people living in the city, they are not supposed to give homes. They are not supposed to give zakat.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it is the farmers. It is the those people who keep cattle in the villages, in the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
They are the ones who have to understand the rules of zakat. They are, some of them, not all of them, because zakat has its taxable limit. Taxable limit.
Right.
For example, if you have 40 camels, you have to give one as zakat.
Mm-hmm.
And if unless the things that you have reach the taxable limit, you are not supposed to give zakat.
I see.
So people who live in the cities, some of the people might want to know whether zakat is payable on gold or not.
Yes.
Zakat is not payable on gold even at this time, because gold is no longer used for bartering, for buying things. Nowadays, people use paper currency. They use coins which are not made of gold.
Yes.
They are no longer using gold as a means for purchasing things, okay?
Yes.
So therefore, zakat is not payable on gold coins also.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, there are specific items on which zakat is payable.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio.